evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Kim Nash. On today's show, a special broadcast, Reintegration and Reconstruction, Rebuilding the Gulf in Ways Beneficial and Inclusive of Residents.
Katrina's force submerged the Gulf Coast. We've heard about the devastation and how the government's benign neglect exacerbated the consequences of the dread storm. But what are the prospects for reconstruction, and how can they be made to benefit and include the now displaced population of New Orleans? Will the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the White House, the federal government continue its pattern of ignoring, or worse, redesign the exclusion from New Orleans of the 67% black population and the 30% of the population that now lives below the poverty line? Special look at New Orleans with Curtis Mohammed, co-founder of the Community Labor United. Let's begin by giving some synopsis of things on the ground in New Orleans, particularly referencing the situation with the potential of people locating back in New Orleans and the situation with having both places to live and a way of earning a living.
First of all, most of the people, most of the black folk who are returning are folk who lived in the midtown and uptown areas, where the flood devastation was not as severe as, say, the Ninth Ward and part of the Sixth and Seventh and so on. So I would estimate maybe 20,000 folk are back in the city. And most of them there working on their homes. And some are there working on jobs that are provided by FEMA. And, well, I say FEMA, but it's probably more like those big corporate guys who come and get all the government contracts. And we all know who they are, Halliburton and so on. The other folk still scattered about. We still have about 120,000 folk in Baton Rouge, about 60 miles away. And every small town within a 50-mile radius of the city probably has about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 folks each. Houston still has about 70,000 or 80,000 folk. The towns between New Orleans and Houston would average about 5,000 each, other than Baton Rouge. Atlanta has about 60,000, 65,000. And the towns between Atlanta and New Orleans, including Mobile and Birmingham and all the other cities along Montgomery, those towns would have anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 each. And we can add up, if we drew a circle around New Orleans, Houston, New Orleans, Jackson, Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi got about 30,000, and the towns between Jackson and New Orleans, about 5 each. When we draw a circle around those towns, we see about 300,000 of our folk within that circle. And then we have of the black folks, particularly, but it's 500. The black folks, they are strong throughout the country. When we're beginning in our collection of stories, we're beginning to note something about class in terms of where people are. The poorer they are, the more they are flung about. So I think that it looks like the poorer the people, the farther away they are. The people who are close in, like Baton Rouge, who can afford to rent apartments or have family nearby, they tend to be the folk who are coming back and forth to New Orleans trying to take care of their properties. And they also tend to be the folk who will move back to the city. The 20,000 to 25,000 who are back in the city are probably more middle class. Projects, the public housing is closed down. All of the houses in the Ninth Ward are closed down. In fact, FEMA wants to bulldoze all of them. They have been evicting everyone. Our lawyers put a temporary stay on it to January 7th. But even that's being contested. They took an area photo of the area and decided the whole area needed to be bulldozed down, and that they were willing to offer $26,000 per house. And then they moved to start evicting people, even in absenteeism. And our case was, you know, you can't evict people without due process. That's primarily what we had on that. The other thing that's happening is the national organizations and local middle-class folk who are associated with national organizations are beginning to create little entities to try to negotiate some largesse for whatever their agendas are. Now, our work is about two things. One, our work is about creating a coalition between all the organizations on the ground, encouraging them to work together, encouraging them to plan and strategize together, keep their hats on, keep their own identity. But if you're working with education, let's all work in the education work group. If you're working on building houses, let's all get in the reconstruction work group and strategize together. If it's public health, let's get in the public health work group and strategize together. And let us all agree to follow the leadership of the grassroots organizing that's happening on the ground. So we've set up this thing on the 9th of December, what we call in the People's Assembly. But we have gone around the country and all over the South where our people are scattered, organized them in those small groups, and they got them to elect people to come to this place, to Jackson, Mississippi, on the 9th. But we've asked all the work groups, which are now about 14 different work groups, to get together a plan of activity that they want to participate in, to put these plans before the people and allow these people to discuss them fully, and to come out with a mandate that we can all follow that is based on the leadership and the voices of the people most affected. That's our plan. Now, we're being opposed by government agencies. We're being opposed by some of the national leadership. We're being opposed by a whole slew of folk who seem to just have their own agendas at heart. But they are slowly beginning to fold in. I mean, the organizations working together now are increasing in larger and larger numbers. Our biggest problem is the problem that we saw at the beginning of this. We think the reason those 100,000 people got locked down in the city is because they were primarily black and poor. And so we've charged all of us. We've charged our whole community, our governments, our churches, our organizations, with being lackadaisical, or prejudiced, or even in some cases having disrespect, distrust, and hatred for poor black people. And that our inability to respond historically to the needs of poor black people was evidenced by what happened with Katrina. We think there might even have been some complicity, because we know that the people were warned. We know that they were warned by the scientific community, by the weather bureaus, by the hurricane commissions. The government agencies were warned. The president's office was warned. The governor's office was warned. The mayor's office was warned. Everybody knew that if a number 5 hurricane hits New Orleans, everybody's dead, including the rats and roaches. Everybody knew it. It was on national television. So what was the complicity? What were the conversations that happened between those agencies, between that warning from the highest officials of this country on the question of hurricane management and on the question of storms and on the question of emergencies? What were the discussions that happened between local, state, and national governments between the time that those warnings came and the time that the hurricane came? They had days. The question here is, were there intentional, planned genocide, or was it just a lackadaisical, unorganized, insensitive response? And that question is central to our problem, because if our government wanted us dead, then we have a new paradigm here. We have a similar paradigm that we had in Germany. If those of us who read this history, the Jews were very late believing that the government would kill them or was killing them. I mean, it was very late in the war before the Jewish community as a whole accepted that reality. And I think we ought to get busy on looking at that, because if that's true, we got to believe that the government is not going to rebuild New Orleans on our behalf, on poor black people's behalf. Our agenda is not their agenda, and our agenda is not going to be implemented unless we do it ourselves, that they have another agenda that does not include us. And it was an accident that we still live in. It was not planned for us to still be living. 100,000 poor black folks supposed to be dead by a natural disaster. But the hurricane changed his mind and went the other way. Someone said it the other night at a meeting I was at, that it happened because it was the day that Emmett Till was lynched. And it was. The day that the hurricane was supposed to hit New Orleans was the day that Emmett Till, the anniversary of the lynching of Emmett Till. And the hurricane changed course and went toward Mississippi instead of New Orleans. That's neither here nor there, but the reality is that Katrina did not do this damage to us. Katrina was 70 miles up the road when the levees broke and the floods started coming in. And nobody came out in loudspeakers and said the levee broke. Nobody came out and said, oh, people, the storm is gone, but we got a problem. They left the people there for 6 more days before the government even tried to do anything. So the people themselves believe that this government tried to murder them. And they have lost faith in their return to that city. So everywhere they have gone, they feel safer than they would feel in New Orleans. And so we have this problem why we demand the right of return for our people. We have a responsibility to build something on the ground that gives them the confidence that somebody cares. So our work, we believe, is to get as many of our people together as we can and say, what is the work? Do we start building houses? Do we start fixing our hospitals and clinics? Do we start fixing our schools? Do we start cleaning up and doing the work that a city is supposed to do? And do we take charge of that ourselves since the government is not going to do it for us? And that's where we are, ma'am.
I wanted to ask, when you say we, who the we is? What is Community Labor United? Who are your allies? And tell us more about your agenda.
Let me help you with the we. First of all, Community Labor United was a coalition of organizations before Katrina. We were a group of organizations that met every third Saturday of every month to plan united activity. We were an active group of about 20 organizations, but that could grow up to 40-something if there was something significant going on. When Katrina happened, we immediately started trying to find and mobilize our people to determine what should happen. We saw our work as facilitators of creating safe space and safe vehicles for the many groups and organizations and individuals who had historically had relationships with us in the city. And the only question we had on the agenda was, what should we be doing? And out of that evolved a broader coalition called the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Oversight Committee, which included the whole Gulf region. It didn't just focus on New Orleans. And we included organizations from the whole Gulf region. So we immediately was working with about 50 or 60 organizations. They included organizations in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, Texas, and in Baton Rouge and other parts of Louisiana who had been affected by the thing, including 4 of the 7 Indian reservations in Louisiana. So that became the People's Hurricane and Relief Fund and Oversight Committee. We've had a series of discussions to plan and put together structure and ideas. We see ourselves as an interim organization, as an interim body, as an interim structure, awaiting this national assembly of our people, where we saw our primary work to find our people, get our people to a place, have these conversations with our people to see what our mandate must be from their voices. So we organized ourselves into 12 to 14 work groups where we were trying to capture the interests of the many folk that was interested in helping. Relief work of just passing out food and clothing was one of the work groups. The other work group was medical and public health, just environmental health, which was 2 different groups, environmental health and public health. The environmental health work group was concerned with testing the water, the air, the soil, trying to see what spaces were safe, what needed to be done to clean up. Education work group, how do we deal with our children while they are in the diaspora, and how do we begin to prepare something for them to return? Our public health people were doing the same thing. They are now evolving a clinic on the ground. It's a couple of clinics already functioning. The reconstruction work group is about finding out how to best assist people in building and fixing and cleaning up their homes. How do we get the technicians in, the training for people? We've got union participation. We've got architect association participation. We've gotten folk from MIT, from LSU, from all kind of different places, even from foreign governments who want to help with the reconstruction. The reconstruction group is now calling for adoption of facilities where schools can adopt schools, hospitals can adopt hospitals. Organizations can adopt what they want, whether it's a block or 2 houses or 3 houses. Churches can adopt churches and so on and so on. Because we think we got to rebuild this. We can keep demanding to the government that they give us the resources, that they support our agenda. But in the final analysis, we don't believe that they either have the capacity or the will to do it.
Can I just push you?
9/11 got average of he had $3.6 million per individual in the amount of money that was raised for those people. We ain't even got nowhere close to that. And the $60 billion that the Congress put up and was raised internationally has already been spent. They've already gone to Congress and said they don't know how they spent it. But those of us on the ground can see where the white people live, where the middle-class people live. The white middle-class communities are already ready to go. They look like a storm has never been there. They have full utilities, full service, restaurants open. Downtown New Orleans is prettier than it's ever been in history. All the hotels are open. The French Quarter is open. Just the black community still sitting there like it looked after the water drained off from Katrina.
I just want to explore the contradiction a little further that you've raised, Brother Muhammad, and that is, on one hand, the critical nature and the importance of the grassroots on the ground organizing for people to empower themselves and to help themselves. But the effort is so massive that other than government really having the resources, shouldn't there be more energy and effort placed on really a national movement to absolutely mandate that government let go of the funds and do that with the oversight, more than the oversight, really the self-determination of the grassroots groups, because they really are the ones who have what is necessary to rebuild for the population that has now been displaced. And, of course, we're talking explicitly about the impoverished, explicitly about people of African ancestry, Latino, and, for that matter, also a significant number of Vietnamese.
Well, you would be surprised at the resistance to this proposition. And this is the thing that most of us cry about. And the tears that I've shed comes from this reality, that the depth of the disrespect, distrust, and hatred for poor black people is deeper than any of us really realized before Katrina. And I really think that we need to rethink, all of us need to rethink our political paradigms that we are in, whether we're the left or the right, whether we're liberals or progressives. You know, what has our relationship been with poor black people historically in this country? We contend it has been nil to none. That these people who sat there to die, that they left to die, are the same people that we left on the plantations at the end of slavery. And they have pretty much not been engaged since. And those people stayed on those plantations as sharecroppers until the automation of the cotton pickers and the tobacco pullers and the sugarcane cutters that forced them into the tenements of the cities. And every city has a group of these people in it, people who have never been educated in any generation. People do not have one relative who've ever seen the inside of a college campus, and people who have never made more than a minimum wage. If you could do some research and go look at the percentage of people that could read, write, and do arithmetic at the end of slavery, it would have gone from about 20 to 25% in 1868 to about 30 to 35% in 2005. And that increase pretty much has been due to that immigration of people moving up to auto industry, steel, postal workers, railroad workers. But pretty much, most of our people were locked on that plantation system in the South until those plantations became automated. And none of us, the movement, well, I will say that SNCC with the MFDP in Mississippi in 1964 and 63 and 62, we were organizing plantation workers. And if you remember, when those plantation workers organized that party and went to the Democratic Convention, we only had two educated people, and those the number of seats they offered us. They did not offer us all eight seats, and we refused them all because we considered it very disrespectful to only offer seats to those who had a college degree.
And that was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
That was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. But never has this country accepted these people as its citizens. They have never educated them. They have never engaged them. And now it looks like they're ready to kill them. And unless we can step it up, all of us, because none of us can claim relationships with poor black people. So we have decided that that's what we're doing. And we're losing friends because of it. I'm telling you, there's a lot of folk, folk that would surprise you, that have a total inability to follow the leadership of grassroots poor black folk. You hear me?
Yes, I do.
I mean, we've been frozen out of the national press. You never heard this talk on no national press. You haven't seen it in one newspaper, national newspaper. But it's been your network of stations is the only media, really, who's been allowing this conversation to take place.
Does that include also the Black Caucus? Does that include the efforts?
Include everybody, darling. I'm sorry. I don't want to call names, but it include them all. Our friends are far and in between. People come to us wanting to change our agenda, wanting to let somebody from Yale or Harvard or Berkeley or MIT or somebody else run this thing because these people are too dumb and stupid. They don't want to take their gift, skills, and talents and put them in tandem behind the leadership of poor black people. Do you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
We have a very serious problem. So, but we're going to keep working with it.
Well, where do we, since you've raised that and you've raised your very, very sharp critique, and there actually has been debate, and I know certainly from what I have seen, there has been serious criticism, much of it directed towards precisely the things you're saying, which I don't happen to concur with. So what do you see as the responsibility of people of goodwill, of people within progressive circles towards assisting the grassroots leadership that seeks to rebuild the areas that they have populated these many years?
That's what I mean when I say we have a paradigm shift here. For the left, for the progressives, for the people of goodwill, we got to rethink this. We have a situation where the descendants of slaves, of field hands, of cotton pickers, of tobacco pullers, of sugarcane cutters, not the house people, not the people who worked in the big houses and learned to read from the children and so on, and thus was able to attend the schools of the great and historical black colleges. We've really been re-educating ourselves generation after generation. But we left those plantation workers out there, and I'm telling you, they still there. So the question here is, for all of us, here's an opportunity for us to use New Orleans as a laboratory, to see if people of goodwill, in the interest of those people, looking at their agenda and their need and hearing their voices as a central part of the process, can rebuild that town. Now, if we can do it in New Orleans, we can do it in Harlem, we can do it in Brooklyn, we can do it in L.A. and Frisco and, the Bay Area, Detroit, every town got this problem of neglected poor black folks and other people of color. We just happen to be at the bottom of this formula of this apartheid. If you lift up that bottom, you will catch everybody in between, just as the Civil Rights Bill did.
And specifically now, what would you like to tell our listeners to do?
Get involved. Join a group. Get in there and work. Get in there and go to work. Join one of the work groups. Call our web page. We got an 800 number now. I hope you got it there because I don't have it in front of me. I might find it before we finish talking.
Okay.
But the web page is www.communitylaborunited.net. And all of this information I'm talking is there, including a listing of the work groups, their convener contact information. They meet by phone almost every week, all of them. So whatever your gift, skills, and talents are, you will join that work group accordingly. Each work group has the autonomy as long as they consider their work to be bottom-up. That is, everything they learn, they share with the people, that they have a technology transfer in mind, teaching folk on the ground what they know, that otherwise they have autonomy to develop along the lines of the consensus they can reach among themselves. And we just set up a coordinating committee that has oversight over all these working groups. Now, some of this could change after the 9th. This is the interim structure. You have to remember that. Once the people meet, the structure could change. But right now, we operate kind of like a Congress. Each little group works, raises its own money, hires its own staff, develops its own budgets and proposals. But the coordinating committee, made up of people off the ground, has oversight over all these proposals. So we have asked all those work groups to have a proposal ready for December 9th so the people we are bringing together can view with us these proposals and then go into discussion about what kind of structure we need to have in place to implement it.
So
we hope, yes.
I'm sorry, just following, again, this leadership, give us the website one more time so people can take you at your word and follow through.
CommunityLaborUnited.net, www.CommunityLaborUnited.net.
And are you encouraging us to come down
to
Mississippi on
to come for the 9th, because our support network will be meeting in a parallel meeting while the people meet. And they will be deciding what kind of structure they need to put themselves in to create maximum support for the people on the ground. The other thing is, we're having a march on the 10th in New Orleans. This big meeting of the People's Assembly is going to be in Jackson, Mississippi, because of housing problems in New Orleans. But we're going to bus everybody down the next day to New Orleans for the big march. And the march is about demanding prosecution for wrongful death, demanding our right to return, and demanding our right to have oversight for all the resources raised on our behalf, and so on and so on. Okay, I'm going to give you this 800 number, sister. It's 1-888-310-7473.
Why don't you do that one more time?
One more time. 1-888-310-7473.
Well, Brother Curtis Muhammad, we'll see you down in Mississippi, and hopefully with many of our listeners as well, and thank you for persevering and staying strong and the continuing demand for self-determination.
Everything is gone. Everything is gone. The clothes on my back is all I own.
And this has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report. Produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Can you read my sign? My signs has helped me, please. Get me off this rooftop. Can somebody rescue me?